Singers President and CEO, Dr. Jaewon Roo.
Thanks, Matt, and thank you, everybody. As we've said before, we really appreciate you all joining us for these sessions and also for all that you do in your daily work. We're hoping, as we've done before throughout the pandemic, that we could deliver some information for you, give you an update of what we're seeing and what our folks and teams are experiencing. We wish we were coming to you with different circumstances. You'll hear about that here momentarily. But I think the punchline here is that COVID continues to rage on. And we're seeing upticks, significant upticks in volume and activity. We'll get to all of that in the numbers. But I think the takeaway message here is it's really strapping and putting strain on the overall healthcare system and infrastructure, not just Geisinger. I know this is going on across our region, across our communities, and really across the country as well. As we've mentioned to you before, you've heard us talk about, you know, we have phenomenal teams. I count my lucky stars every day that we have 24,000 strong as far as employees helping to wage this war. But that being said, I think suffice it to say everybody's tired, and you're going to hear momentarily from Dr. Essie Reed, as Matt introduced, one of our frontline emergency medicine physicians, really right there at the front row seat of watching this take place and really in the ring, if you will. Essie also serves as our medical director of EMS services. I thought we'd mix it up a little bit. I know we try to do these briefings every 4 to 6 weeks or so. I know sometimes last year it was more frequent than that. But partly what we tried to do is bring you information and try to give you a feel for what's going on. And we thought we'd mix it up this time by having a different voice and bring to you really what she is seeing and experiencing. So let me turn it over to Dr. Reed, and then I'll come back and we'll go through our normal briefing.
Thank you, Dr. Roo, for allowing me the time to speak and hijack part of your press conference and kind of give the community an update and be a little bit of a voice for my colleagues and explain what we're seeing on the front lines of this pandemic. We're almost 2 years into this, and it still feels like every day is a crisis when we go to work. The easiest way to describe that feeling is that we're sort of always feeling like we're waiting for the Jenga tower to fall, and we just never know when that's going to come. It's very defeating as healthcare workers, and I mean at every level across the region, to live almost in two parallel worlds, one where we go to work and kind of, as Dr. Roo said, kind of take it in the ring and get beat up a little bit, and then the outside world where society sort of feels like, oh, this pandemic is behind us and we're going on with our daily lives. I don't think it is behind us, and I expect that the numbers today will spell that out for us all, that it's probably worse than it was last year. And I want to tell you a little bit about what it's like and what we're seeing cases and how it is to go to work. This is not the kind of medicine that we wanted to practice. And this isn't the way that we want to take care of our patients. We want to do better and we need your help. Our patients are seeing 10 to 20 hour wait times to be seen in the emergency department. And we're starting to practice waiting room medicine, which is something I never imagined I would see in my career. We're diagnosing perforated bowel and running CAT scans and doing lab work and any sort of test that we can from patients that are waiting for us in the waiting room. We're starting oxygen on COVID patients in the hallway, and those hallway beds are often double and triple bunked. And we're doing that because we're trying to make space to see more patients as all of our inpatient beds and ICU beds are full. And I know our colleagues upstairs on the floors and in the intensive care units are feeling the burn just as much. We're seeing it on every level with staffing. The emergency department wasn't designed to be run with inpatient holds and ICU holds. And our nurses are powering through taking care of multiple critical patients all day, every day. And we're all, you know, hoping that we continue to manage this because I have rock star colleagues that, you know, when the next emergency comes in, we're still there and able to handle that. But this trickles down outside of our emergency department and outside of our hospital walls. Dr. Roo mentioned part of my job is as an EMS medical director. And so we're seeing this trickle down in the community as well. Our EMS providers are stacking up in the emergency department, waiting for beds as we're struggling to find room for patients. And so when you call 911, we want them to have quick turnaround times because we want them to be there for you. We don't want an ambulance to have to come from the other end of the county to make it to your emergency. Again, this is not how we want to be practicing medicine, and we need your help. We are begging you to get vaccinated, and the following cases are pretty illustrative as to why. I recently saw a young man in his late 20s who is 6 months post-COVID with a chest x-ray that looks like florid COVID. He's still on oxygen and may never be able to come off, and he's 28 years old. I recently took care of a married couple who refused the vaccine and had refused proven therapies that my brilliant infectious disease colleagues have vetted and designed protocols for us, and they both prematurely left their family members behind them. Young, vibrant people. We want to make these stories come to an end. We want to do our best to support each other so that we're not taking our turns crying in the med closet over unnecessarily watching patients die. So much of this is preventable, and that's really why we're asking for your help. This isn't something we normally do. This isn't an approach we normally take. I would say that this is unprecedented times, and we're all dying for some precedented times. But for right now, this is where we're at, and we need your help. Please, 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 if you are not vaccinated, ask a trusted healthcare professional. Get the information that you need to feel comfortable getting the vaccine. If you're eligible to get the booster, please do so. We need your help as much as you hopefully will not need ours. So thank you for the time. Thank you for listening. Please take these stories into consideration. I'm going to turn it back over to Dr. Rue.
So thank you, Dr. Reed. Sobering kind of wake-up call kind of words. Very, very compelling. It's always compelling when I walk around our facilities and talk to our teams, just hearing the gravity of the situation and what's going on. These things are real. I know it's sometimes easy to go through the numbers, as we do with all of you, but oftentimes, in fact, almost always, it's the stories behind those numbers that really makes this particularly real. So speaking of the numbers, let's turn to some of those numbers, as we've always done. You just heard us talk about the fact that we are seeing unprecedented volumes. We're heading exactly to where we were this time last year, and this is really a graph which you're seeing. The blue line demonstrates our daily COVID inpatients inside the hospital from 2020, and then you could see the matching up, 2021, and then you could see the red, which is the 2020 number, and the graphs are remarkably the same. I think what's different right now is we're probably about 2 weeks ahead of pace versus where we were last year. So just by way of example, December 5th of this year, so just a few days ago, we had 323 admitted patients with COVID. December 5th of last year was 275. So we're a little bit ahead of where we were last year. And just to put it into reference, about 1 month ago, exactly 1 month ago, in early mid-November, we were looking at about half the levels of what we're seeing today. And so it's really picked up and climbed quite a bit just in a one-month period. And, you know, that's clearly not a wave that's reassuring to us. Last year, our overall peak was up around 390. And that, if you'll recall, I think many of you may have been on some of these media briefings at the time, it really did stretch our infrastructure to its limits. But as Dr. Reed alluded to, and I would agree with her, I think many of us would say this year is probably worse. And that has to do with the fact that there are a lot of non-COVID issues that still need to be addressed as well. And you've heard us talk about some of these, but I will go through some of them. So people still get heart attacks and strokes and get into car accidents and other traumas, and they need to be taken care of. And this is all hitting at the same time that, of course, this COVID wave is hitting. And what we're also seeing this year is that flu and RSV, another sort of respiratory virus, they're already creeping into the picture. And we know that flu season and RSV season will continue to pick up as we head into deeper into these winter months. Last year, we didn't see so much of that. And I think it had to do with there's less activity going on around the communities, probably more masking than there is now. I think all of those things made last year a little more manageable, but at least from the health system standpoint. But this year, all of those things are fully back into swing while at the same time managing through COVID, which poses particular challenges. I think the other thing to remember is that some folks think, well, this is COVID. As long as I could avoid COVID, I should be okay. Well, no. As we've said before, this impacts folks even if they have non-COVID care needs. So even if you have that heart attack, or as Dr. Reed alluded to, you may call 911 because you need that ambulance, and it's having to come from further away because it's tied up doing a lot of other things. Those things all factor in. The other thing that I would mention, and I think many of you are aware, we are seeing significant rises in behavioral health needs. And so all of these factors contribute to the hospitals being extremely, extremely full. And the resources, especially on the critical care side, are extremely scarce. And you heard Dr. Reed reference that as well. Folks waiting for beds has sort of become a common theme, happening every minute, every hour of every day. And it's also impacting areas beyond the hospitals. So if you go to nursing homes or rehab facilities or inpatient psychiatric facilities, all of those places are also experiencing gridlock, and that pushes upstream into folks in the hospital who may need to move on to those kinds of environments who are not easily able to do so because of so much volume hitting the system at the same time. I think the other is just about all of our campuses, and we have the numbers here, and I'm looking at them right now, are either at or above capacity in recent weeks. Some ICUs, in fact, many of our ICUs are looking at 120% of capacity in recent weeks. And let me go through it a little bit. As a system, we are operating at 110% of capacity in our total beds. That means that people who really need an inpatient bed are sitting in locations and places that were not meant to be long-term beds. And you heard Dr. Reed mention some of those. And we project that number will be increasing in the coming days, because based on how many positive tests we're seeing and based on the percentage of positive tests, we know that we have pretty good line of sight on what comes in the coming days. And this is a graph that shows you that. Again, you see 2020 in red, 2021 in blue, and you could see that, again, the curves look remarkably similar in terms of what we're seeing come down from our communities. So as a system, we're at 110%. At GMC here in Danville, we're at 110%, and 23% of those are COVID cases. At GWV up in Wilkes-Barre, we're at 120% of capacity, and 24% of those are COVID. At Geisinger-Shamokin, we're at 115% of capacity, and 42% of those are COVID. At our Bloomsburg campus, we are at 115% capacity, and 38% of that is COVID. Out at Lewistown, we're at 90% of capacity, with 31% being COVID. Now, if you had asked me that a month ago, it was reversed. That was the place where we were seeing the most activity. And then lastly, but not least, Jersey Shore, our Jersey Shore campus, 130% of capacity, and 61% is COVID. And believe it or not, just in the last week, there was a day up at our Jersey Shore campus where every single patient admitted to that hospital, other than one, was admitted there for COVID. And so you could see the kind of strain that this puts on the entirety of the system. This graph is something you've seen before. It tracks our overall inpatient COVID trend, the trend of those in the ICUs, and the trend of those on ventilators. I think suffice it to say, all of our ERs are extremely full. Many of our walk-in centers are seeing hours-long waits, especially as people are coming in for COVID testing and others. We encourage folks to use our website and to find the other sites where we do have dedicated COVID testing, where they may not need to come into the urgent cares or the ERs for those services. At the same time, as we've done throughout the pandemic, you've heard us talk about the dimmer switch as opposed to the light switch in terms of dialing back and scaling back on non-emergent, non-urgent elective procedures. And we're doing more and more of that as well. Another way that even non-COVID patients are being impacted, whether it's a hip or a knee, replacement surgery, or even now having to prioritize things like heart valve repair. Yes, they're not emergencies, but they really need to be addressed quickly. And of course, those decisions are becoming more and more different or difficult. So those are the kinds of things that are playing out, and those types of services are what this might look like, already are starting to look like. It's why we're continuing to encourage very strongly folks to get vaccinated. It is the single best arrow in the quiver. You've heard me say that before as well, in terms of stemming the tide of this pandemic. It's effective against COVID. We know that. We've been conveying that as far as the science and the evidence every chance we get, but it also indirectly helps with those non-COVID issues because it creates extra capacity inside the healthcare system to take care of those other needs. Our data that we continue to track is reinforcing the effectiveness of the vaccine. So we thought we'd share some of that with you as well. It is consistent with what our colleagues throughout the country are seeing, whether it's a health system here locally, our colleagues down the street, so to speak, or even colleagues in adjacent states, or even colleagues even in the western or southern parts of the country, there's a remarkable consistency. So if you look a couple days ago, you know, at midnight, we had 302 admitted COVID patients. 90% of those were not vaccinated. And 8% of those were vaccinated, but it had been longer than 6 months since they had gotten their vaccine. And we do know that all immunity decreases over time. And so I think that's a function, and you're reading a lot about that's why the recommendation around boosters. But we are seeing that phenomenon. And just 2% of those in our hospitals were within 6 months of their vaccination. And so that gives you a sense of, you know, you've been vaccinated fairly recently, within 6 months. It is remarkably effective at preventing serious infection that would merit a hospitalization. At the same time, we know that no vaccination is ever 100% effective. And so at the same time, we're continuing to share the effectiveness data, how to understand so that people are not arriving at misleading kinds of conclusions. But that's the spirit in which we do these briefings for you all as well. Most importantly, I think with the vaccine, it's really effective at preventing hospitalization and death. And those are the outcomes we care about. Are there breakthrough infections? Absolutely there are. But when you avoid and prevent hospitalization and death, it preserves beds, it preserves ICU capacity, it preserves ventilators, it preserves staff. You go down the line, it preserves all of those things, and it allows us to continue to take care of people from non-COVID issues as well. I think the unfortunate thing here, and you heard Dr. Reed mention it, is that what we're going through here is largely preventable, especially with the vaccination, which is why we're asking everybody to consider and then consider again getting the vaccination. If you have not done so, it's for you, it's for your loved ones, it's for your neighbors, friends, family, whoever. And if you have gotten vaccinated, but it's been greater than 6 months, we also encourage you to consider that booster as well. As we head into the holidays, and I know we just had Thanksgiving, maybe we should have done this the week before Thanksgiving, but really wanted to encourage everybody to still be mindful of those large gatherings and events. We know that people need time with their families. We encourage that, but to do so in as safe a way as possible. Obviously, the colder weather limits somewhat what we're able to do outside, but as we've always said, outdoors is going to be better than indoors. Masked is going to be better than unmasked. Vaccinated is going to be better than non-vaccinated. And so keep those things in mind as we continue through this holiday season. For nearly 2 years, and it's amazing that we're coming up on 2 years here, our team has just done remarkable work. What can I say? I'm tremendously thrilled and proud to be leading this organization. But as they fight the good fight, continuing to do whatever's needed. We're going to continue to do that, but we do ask for people's help because this is one where we've said before, we are truly all in this together, and whatever we can do as a community to dampen this trend and to fight it back, I think that'll position all of us better to have continued access to healthcare services for many of these other things that continue to wage on regardless of COVID. So thank you all for what you're doing, and thank you for joining us here. But let me turn it over for questions.
Thank you, Dr. Root. First question we have is from the Milton Standard Journal. With nearly 2 years of, quote, field experience, are staffers and others who deal with the virus getting better at dealing with spikes, such as EMS, emergency departments, physicians, et cetera?
Yeah, so I think the short answer is yes. I do think we have more of those arrows in the quiver. A good example is the monoclonal antibody, which can be infused. But the other thing to remember here is it can't be used on everybody. There are certain criteria for people who would benefit from it, and there's a certain timeline on which you have to administer it. So I think that's something that helps but may not help everyone. So we do have access to more things like that. But at the same time, there are unique challenges that are hitting us this year that were not there, frankly, last year. I think there are a lot more non-COVID things, as you heard us say earlier, that we're continuing to grapple with, whether it's psychiatric needs, those heart attacks, strokes, congestive heart failure, the auto accidents, the other traumas. I think we're seeing a lot more of that that make this even more challenging, even though we have more arrows in that quiver. I think the other is sort of the gridlock and the overrunning of the healthcare infrastructure. I think we're seeing more of that this year as everybody, not just hospitals, but even the nursing homes, the rehab facilities, the psychiatric facilities, all of these other places in the spectrum of healthcare, if you will, I think there is difficulty to find capacity in each and every one of those spaces. And what that does is it pushes everything upstream or downstream, however you want to think about it, the trickle down that Dr. Reed was talking about, and we're seeing that. So the average length of stay in our system, typically in a non-COVID world, maybe 4.5 days. Some things are shorter, some things are longer. What we're seeing with COVID cases, the average length of stay is actually as long as 8 days. And so that has a tendency to gobble up the capacity as well. I think all of this leads us to, you know, what I've been saying here, which is that the strongest thing that we have and the best arrow in the quiver and the thing that really separates us most from this time last year is the existence of the vaccine, the availability of the vaccine. So we're continuing to encourage at every opportunity folks to consider and reconsider, and if they've already gotten it, to go ahead and get boosted if they're beyond 6 months.
And another one from the Milton Standard Journal, are there any new logistical challenges, such as where to put people coming into the emergency department?
Yeah, so the backlogs, that is the day in and day out of what Dr. Reed and many others in our system are dealing with. So if I look at, you know, the typical spectrum of how a person may move inside a hospital, they may go from the ER up to a floor bed. And if they get severe or if they're decompensating or if they're sick enough, they may go to an ICU bed. But when the ICUs are jammed up, then you can't really move people from the beds, from the non-ICU beds into those ICU beds, which means that the people from the ER can't move into those normal beds. And so it has this cascading ripple effect across the system and even outside the campuses, as Dr. Reed mentioned, even impacting things like paramedics and ambulance transport times and so forth. You heard me also talk about the impact of, you know, other actors in the system who are similarly facing these same challenges, whether it's nursing homes or rehab centers or long-term acute care hospitals or psychiatric facilities. When they get gridlocked, then the hospitals can't necessarily discharge folks who need to go to those places, which then creates a backlog that goes back into the ERs and into the ambulance and into the homes and clinics and so forth. And so the flow challenges and logistical challenges, they're complicated, but I think at the end of the day, It's a reminder that what happens in one area of healthcare really impacts what happens in every other segment of healthcare, and that's what we're seeing right now.
From the Daily Item, can you talk to the differences in vaccine effectiveness with respect to mitigating transmission and reducing the risk of severe illness? Is it fair to say this surge is accurately attributed to the unvaccinated population?
Yeah, I think the best data point that we track, and again, this is one that's been unbelievably consistent across many different colleague organizations throughout the country, is that we have consistently seen about 88 to 90, 92% of our hospitalized patients are unvaccinated. And even among those who are vaccinated, i.e. with the breakthrough infections you saw earlier, you know, 8% of those remaining end up being those who have been vaccinated, but not in the most recent 6 months. And then we've done some analysis in that population as well, and they tend to have some comorbidities going on as well. And so I think that's the most compelling number I would point to, that the vaccine is still extremely effective at preventing the serious infections and the hospitalizations and, of course, the death as an outcome. There are breakthrough infections. There's no doubt about that. But even the infectivity we know is lower with the vaccine versus without the vaccine. And we've also quoted numerous studies that have found the risk of hospitalization between vaccinated and unvaccinated populations. There are two, I think, most prominent studies that looked at that, and one found an 11x difference and the other found a 19x difference. And so there's a significantly lower risk of bad outcomes if you've been vaccinated.
Several outlets, WKOK, The Daily Item, The Milton Standard Journal, and WBRE, have asked, has Geisinger had any cases of the Omicron variant, and how do you test for it?
So I think it was a couple months ago, our lab started doing, on a regular basis, it's once monthly, roughly, we do a random sampling of the COVID-positive cases, and we type them just to see what's going on from an epidemiologic standpoint in the community. You've heard us talk before about the fact that clinically it doesn't make one bit of difference between which kind of variant you may have. The treatments are the same, the approach is the same, and the decision-making ends up being the same as well. So we don't do this as a matter of course on each and every. You don't need to. It won't change your treatment. But we do think it's important to know what's out there in our communities. The most recent time we checked this was in November. And we, from that random sample, just about all of the cases in this area were Delta. Now, at the time, that was before Omicron had really settled in. But given that we're seeing cases, hearing about cases from, you know, Canada and then the U.S. and now even closer to home in Philadelphia, that's just a matter of time. It will be here if it's not here already. And so I think it's safe to say we should just work under that assumption.
And the last question, again, several outlets have asked, WKOK, Daily Item, Press Enterprise, Penn Live, can any staffing shortages be attributed to losing employees from the mandatory vaccine policy?
No, I think this is one that we've been pleasantly surprised with and thrilled about is, you know, we lost, unfortunately, this is the unfortunate side of things, we lost 153 of our workforce, so 0.6% due to the vaccine mandate. But believe it or not, we gained back many hundreds of folks back into our workforce because we have fewer of our employees out on quarantine at any time, which you would expect in a largely vaccinated population. And so prior to the completion of that policy and the deadline of that policy, we were routinely seeing up above 1,000 and often 1,100, 1,200 of our employees on any given day out of commission because they were out on quarantine. Today, I believe that number is in the 700s. And so, yes, we've lost 153. No one's thrilled about that part. But at the same time, we have several fewer hundred on any given day out on quarantine. And that's a really good thing. So net, we think it's actually added people into our work environments and not taken away.